You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Happy Thursday, beautiful friends, neighbors, Canadians, coast to coast to coast. How's everybody doing today? We have an absolute crackerjack show. And sometimes things happen and you didn't expect it. Earlier this week, we read this article on the Big Show here. And I know everyone's concerned about the border and the opening of the U.S. border. Probably the biggest story. Will people with double vax be able to get past? And what's going on? Why is it taking so long? So, yeah, we will talk to the man in charge of it, the Minister of Public Safety and Border Services, Bill Blair. He's on the show today, so we'll ask him all those questions. Why is it taking so long? Why November? What's the final date? So we'll get to that. You know, this is the program where, as we always bring on the players to bring you the answers, and then you could figure out, I like this person, I don't like that person. They're full of it. They're not full of it. I wish they had more answers. I wish they didn't. Your call. We just like to, as I say, throw balls and strikes. So we'll get that today. Don't you worry about that. Good news, by the way, that it's open. So we're thinking about that today. And I read this article, and I said to Samantha, isn't this crazy that Norway, little Norway, is going to have 100% electric vehicle sales early next year? Like, all their cars sold will be electric. And remember, Will Ferrell did that hilarious Cadillac commercial for Cadillac's new car on Norway. So we phoned the ambassador from Norway and said, hey, would you like to come on and talk about that? He said, yeah, I can come on Thursday. And then, so he's coming on today. So we book him to talk about this. And then very tragically, as you all know, what could be a terror attack has happened. A man with a bow and arrow killed five people and wounded two others with a bow and arrow in about 50 clicks from the capital of Oslo in Kongsberg. And he's in custody now. It could be a terrorist. A bow and arrow murder? Mass murder with a bow and arrow? Anyway, that's happened. So the ambassador of Norway is actually here. He's going to talk to us about that and about the cars, just crazily enough. But here's what I want to talk about today on the start of the show, the Big Show. You know how much I talk about the veterans. And I talk about people who serve because most of my life I'm covering people who are trying to serve the public, elected officials. And as you know, my position always, my starting principle, and you know, I always try to analyze things as what is the principle and then what are the strategies. The principle first and the strategy second. That's kind of the analytical tool I use. Like, what's the fundamental principle at work here? And what is the principle? And then if you're good or bad at it, what's the cost benefit? So the principle of a democracy is I really value and I admire people who want to serve the country. I do, as my fundamental principle. Service is good. Then that's my fundamental principle. So I really take my hat off to people, elected officials and public servants and military people like the men and women in the military who are serving our country in whatever capacity. But then I analyze it fair and square. That's the principle. I like that. Let's preserve the principle and encourage people to serve in whatever capacity they want. But then let's analyze the cost benefit. Are the costs too high? Is the service good or bad? How do we get it better? That's the politics of it, right? I think the service could be better doing X. I think the service could be better doing Y. And if you're not doing a good job, there's got to be an accountability mechanism. So I always call myself a skeptical optimist, not a cynic, a skeptical optimist. And I want to say something to the men and women who serve our country. You are the very highest form of this kind of service because you're prepared to give your lives for the system that we live under. And I've been in the field many times with the men and women in uniform as a journalist, seeing them, whether in naval, on ships with them in the Persian Gulf, with the infantry, whether doing documentaries and seeing how the snipers train. I just have the highest respect for the men and women who serve. And that's why it is such a crushing disappointment to find out yet another story of a senior military leader who is now under the cloud of an allegation. This time, the incoming Canadian Army commander, Lieutenant General Trevor Cadieux, who was supposed to be promoted to the head of the Army, and now he's being investigated for sexual misconduct. And CTV News, as my great colleague, Annie Bergeron Oliver, reported last night with Lisa LaFlamme on the National News, has learned that a female veteran filed an allegation of sexual misconduct against Cadieux, and she spoke to the Canadian Forces National Investigative Service in September. And then the guy, the lieutenant general who was supposed to take over from the Army on September 7th, was suspended by the acting chief of the defense staff. By the way, the acting chief of the defense staff, why is he the acting? Because the former chief of the defense staff, Art MacDonald, was suspended under a cloud. He's just been exonerated. And he was the new one because the one before that, the acting chief, General Vance, is accused of sexual misconduct. He denies it, but that's in court as well. Or not in court, that's being investigated. Can you imagine this? And that's not the only one. On and on and on and on. So here we are in September, the Canadian military reeling under senior leadership being investigated and allegations of sexual misconduct or sexual harassment. And they can't get a leader. Cadieux served 29 years. He served in Afghanistan. He served in Bosnia. Now, again, he says, I know that these false claims will, as intended, create doubts about my ability to lead in this environment, he wrote. Well, I have devoted every day of my career to making fellow members feel respected and included. Canadian Army soldiers deserve a leader who is unencumbered by allegations and can lead at this important time when culture change, addressing systemic misconduct, and preparing tactical teams operation must remain a priority. So he's acknowledging that. But here's the problem, and I'll read you what the military statement is, as Annie said that last night. But again, Cadieux calls these false claims, right? But as CTV News has learned, we don't know. A female veteran filed an allegation of sexual misconduct and spoke to the military about it. The military says the postponement of the ceremony is not an indictment of Lieutenant General Cadieux. However, in light of the ongoing investigation, a decision was made to allow the justice system to pursue the matter in accordance to the rule of law. Let's just say this. We hope there's a real rule of law. An allegation is not a form of guilt. And we had Mary Hennin, the great lawyer, criminal lawyer, on saying that. So we are not here in any way, shape, or form to judge Lieutenant General Cadieux or anyone until the system comes to its judgment. Let's be fair about that. But this is the problem. Leader after leader is falling under a cloud of investigation. And I'll tell you who must take accountability for this. The Minister of Defense, Harjit Sajjan, who himself is a veteran. For 6 years, he's been the Minister of Defense. For 5.5 years, as we now know from the retired Supreme Court Justice Fish report, that there have been thousands and thousands of allegations of sexual abuse in the last 6 years, that nothing has changed since the first retired Supreme Court judge put out a report on sexual abuse in the military and sexual harassment in the military almost 6 years ago. Nothing changed. Nothing changed, except all the leaders are now under a cloud, it seems. These major leaders, and only one man has escaped accountability, and that's the Minister of Defense. How do you appoint a guy that this allegation is not known before? This is corroding faith in the leadership of the finest organization we have, which are men and women in the military, men and women who want to serve, and they're seeing these allegations. There is a cabinet shuffle coming. I cannot imagine Harjit Sajjan remains as the defense minister, but I will say this, that's not the form of accountability. How did this happen? The men and women of our military deserve not a little better, a lot better. All right, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, Jason Kenney, who's in such political trouble, wants to tinker with the entire Constitution. Oh yeah, we'll find out why next. We'll be right back.
As your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
Oh, Jason Kenney. I knew Jason Kenney well when he was the minister. I remember taking a flight when he was a minister in the Harper government, and I was doing something in Windsor. It was like, I'm not exaggerating, it was a 5 a.m. flight, so we're 4 a.m. at the airport. It was an obscure airport, and Jason Kenney, then the immigration minister, was on the flight. And I'd known Jason for a long time. And he was going to some event on an early morning flight. And I was like, Jason, it was a tiny little plane, you know, the regional flights. And I'll tell you what Jason was doing. He was working hard on the plane, sitting alone in his files. And I was like, that guy is hardworking. And no one doubts Jason Kenney is hardworking. The question is, has the hardworking version of Jason Kenney been replaced by the tin-eared political Jason Kenney as the premier of Alberta? His polls are low. He's mismanaged the COVID crisis in an almost, I mean, it's not, it's tragic way. It's a tragic way. And now he's decided to fulfill this obscure campaign promise. And this, in the middle of a pandemic, he's decided, oh, Albertans, you know what you should really focus on? The complexities of equalization. And in fact, on October 18th, during the municipal elections, because there's a municipal elections on October 18th, there's going to be a question on equalization, because Alberta feels, Alberta, per capita, the richest province in the country, the lowest tax, everything. They feel that equalization, I should say, a formula negotiated last by Stephen Harper, the senior minister being Jason Kenney, to make it both from Alberta, is so unfair that they need to sort of threaten to blow up the Constitution. And here's what Jason Kenney has said about this.
Albertans will be going to the polls to vote on reforming equalization, on saying yes to a fair deal.
Yes, yeah, a fair deal. They need a fair deal. And he says the vote won't change the Constitution, of course, but it's going to elevate it to the top of the agenda. They're going to fight. So Ken Bozenkoul, who was a senior campaign advisor and policy advisor to Stephen Harper, and another colleague decided to write an article about that. Now, so Ken worked in the Harper government, and he's now a professor at the Max Bell School of Public Policy at McGill University and a research fellow at the C.D. Howe Institute. He wrote a great article saying, yeah, Jason Kenney, you're wrong. Equalization is not ripping off Alberta. You don't really understand what you're talking about, and people should vote no to it. And I read it, and, you know, when Ken writes something, usually it's very, very smart, and this was no exception, and he joins us now. Hey, Ken.
Hey, Evan. How are you?
That's all the time we've got for you. See you later. No, I'm just kidding. What most people have no bloody idea how equalization works, except to say, they say, hear this. Equalization means that Albertans are essentially paying for Quebec to have childcare because Quebec gets it, big money transferred to them out of our pockets. Can you explain how it actually works?
So equalization is a program where the federal government collects taxes from every Canadian across the country, and then looks at provinces that are unable to raise revenues to the Canadian average and tops them up so that they have as much revenue as the average province in Canada. And with that revenue, they can deliver services like healthcare that are of the same sort of quality that exist in provinces that are richer than them. So it's really a way for the federal government to allow provinces to run more of their own affairs and distribute the money in a way that allows that to happen by giving money to poor provinces and taking the money from all Canadians.
Right. And so when they say Alberta puts in way more than anybody else, and we pay for all these services. So stop. It's so unfair that we are not getting an equalization payment when Quebec's getting it. Is that true?
No. So can I just, what's happened in Alberta, and every politician from the Stone Age in Alberta has confused what I call big E equalization, which is the equalization program, and small E equalization, which is how Alberta fares in the Federation, you know, how much money we send to Ottawa versus how much money we get back.
Right.
And those are two very different conversations, but politicians have confused the two of them for their own partisan purposes. And I would argue that this referendum is Exhibit A1 in that.
Okay, so explain the difference, Ken Bozenkoul.
Well, you know, Alberta's a rich province. So when we pay taxes, we pay more than other provinces, and we get back less because we're a rich province. So that's, I mean, that's about 60% of the money that goes out of Alberta to the rest of the country and doesn't come back is because we're rich, which is great.
Can I just, let me just explain. I just want to be rich, meaning the per capita income of the average Albertan, even though a lot of people say, God, Alberta's been killed in the collapse of the price of oil, although it's, I know it's gone up, but still, Alberta per capita has the highest levels of income. So when you have the highest levels of income, naturally, you're going to pay the highest levels of tax. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and it's not even close. It used to be not even close, and now it's getting a little closer. But we're still the richest province in Canada. So that, so this is what happens. But there's also a bunch of other programs. In the 1990s, the cash transfer from the federal government to the provinces gave less money to Alberta than it gave to other provinces. And there were a bunch of people like me who said that was unfair. And we helped a guy get a guy elected named Stephen Harper who fixed that. And now the health transfer is given equal per capita across the country. So the way to make Canada more fair is for Albertans to work with Ontarians of a conservative persuasion, get them elected to Ottawa, and fix some of these problems. The solution isn't for Alberta to bang its spoon on its high chair and say, we want a more fair federation. And that's my big problem with this referendum. It doesn't actually accomplish anything. And there are ways to accomplish and fixing some of these other issues.
What about, you know, Brad Wall has been on the show and he says, wait a second, you know, why is Quebec, which is funding $10 a day daycare, and they've got all this great stuff, and they're getting billions of $11 billion in equalization in Alberta. It's going through a crunch and we're losing jobs and our unemployment is high. We're getting nothing. It's classically unfair. What's the response?
Brad Wall was a great premier and a good friend, but here's the reality. If Alberta had the same tax rates that Quebec has, we'd be running surpluses twice as big as the deficits we're running. So Quebec has made a choice. Quebec has said, we're going to have high taxes. We're going to tax people a lot heavier in Quebec than Alberta. We're going to have a sales tax. We're going to have heavier income taxes. And that's how we're going to pay for these things. The ability of the Quebec government remains, the ability of the Quebec government to raise revenue remains lower than the ability of Saskatchewan and Alberta to raise revenue.
But I mean, I know Albertans got the lower tax rate, but why does Quebec get so much more equalization than Alberta?
Because their ability to raise revenue is lower than the ability of Alberta to raise revenue. And that's how the equalization program works. That's how it should work. They've decided that even though it takes them a lot more work to raise the same revenue, they want to have higher taxes. And that's a decision that they made in Quebec, and more power to them. If that's the way they want to run their provincial government, they can do that. But to say that that's somehow unfair to Alberta just misunderstands the nature of what Alberta has decided it wants to do and what Quebec has decided it wants to do.
So just, God, I love this conversation. Ken Bozenkul kind of breaking down. This is, folks, worth billions and billions of dollars, and it's a big political stick. And I know I got a minute here. I know you're arguing vote no to this referendum, and I wonder if it's just a big, I know it's a campaign promise, but it seems like a big political distraction to the big picture for Jason Kenney. But real quick, what is the fix then?
The fix is to elect a national conservative majority government to help fix these things, which we did, and had Stephen Harper fixed a lot of these problems. There's still things we can fix. So let's get Aaron O'Toole or whoever the leader of the Conservative Party is elected.
But this is crazy. Jason Kenney was part of the Harper government that literally changed the equalization formula. Now he's coming to Alberta. He's like, rip the equalization formula. It's unfair. The very formula that he supported. I just don't understand it.
I don't either.
Amazing. Hey, your article was where can people read it? I know you can Google Ken Bozenkul and the article on equalization. The reason it's not just for most of our listeners, they're not voting in this necessarily, but you know, equalization is a really important program and how our federation works. And just actually understanding it outside of the political spin is one of the great benefits of this article. So I really urge people to read this article. Ken, thanks for your time, by the way, and your work. I really appreciate it.
Good to be here. Cheers.
Ken Bozenkul, now a prof at McGill at the Max Bell School, former senior policy advisor and campaign advisor to Stephen Harper. And there it is. That's Ken Bozenkul. Just to say, hey, don't fall for the political spin on this stuff. I just love that. Cutting through the crap. Oh, we're going to try to cut through the crap next with Bill Blair on the open border. That's all we do. Get your scissors.
Finding answers to all your questions. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
So the border's open, folks. Well, it's going to be open. Finally, for non-essential travelers who are double vax, you will soon be able to go over the border between Canada and the U.S. The Americans who are double vax can come here, but we haven't been able to do this unless you fly. So now the White House is confirming, yeah, you can do that after 19 months. We don't know when. And will people with mixed doses of the vaccine, I don't know, the AstraZeneca, Pfizer combo, AstraZeneca, Moderna, will they be allowed to cross? The Minister of Public Safety, Bill Blair, joined me on that. He's the man in charge of this. And I started by asking him, Minister, do you know exactly, what is the exact date of when this border is going to be reopened?
Yeah, we've had a number of conversations with our colleagues and counterparts in the United States. The only date that they've given us is early November. I know that they've got a couple of things that they're working through, and there's a Canada-U.S. Operational readiness group that meets on a weekly basis that are working out the details of that. But we know they're certainly aiming for early November.
Early November. What triggered the decision? Can you tell us?
Well, first of all, this has been an ongoing discussion with us for several months. I had a number of conversations with my counterpart, Secretary Mayorkas, back in August when we were contemplating and when we eventually did change our posture at the border to allow fully vaccinated Americans with a negative molecular test to enter the country for non-essential purposes. And we've been engaged in conversation with them ongoing. And so this is work that has been taking place and conversations we've been having with our American colleagues for some period of time. I think they've reached the point now of the level of vaccination in their country, the lowering case counts. They've seen, I think they've been able to witness, that the border can be very effectively managed for fully vaccinated travelers, as we have done in Canada. And now they've announced that they're going to take what will essentially be a reciprocal step.
Okay. I mean, the other question is, why is it taking another 3 weeks to a month to do this? Why can't they just flip the switch now? Americans can come to our country. We can't go to their country for not. Why is it taking weeks or a month?
Well, I'll tell you, when we did it, there was a lot of work that went into making sure that we were ready and to establish with our Border Service officers and with the Public Health Agency of Canada to make sure that we had the capacity to receive an increased volume of travelers to verify, in fact, that they were fully vaccinated. We also have a requirement of a negative PCR test upon arrival into the country. And so we put that in place. You'll recall that we actually did a bit of a pilot in early July, in which we began to allow Canadian travelers to enter in for non-essential purposes without going into quarantine if they were fully vaxxed. In August, we extended that to American travelers, and then in September to all foreign nationals. And so I think we've established a pretty solid track record on how this can be operationalized. But I also recognize and respect the Americans have a bit of work to do in order to make sure that they'll be fully ready to make this change at their border, which will make it sort of in harmonized to a large degree with us.
I think the big question for millions of Canadians who have a mixed vaccine, including the Prime Minister, including Aaron O'Toole, who have an AstraZeneca and a Pfizer, an AstraZeneca and a Moderna, will Canadians with mixed doses be able to cross the border? Is that solved?
No. Well, the work is ongoing, and what I can tell you is the Americans have already announced their intention to accept all of the vaccines that we are currently using in Canada, including AstraZeneca. And as you know, AstraZeneca was not approved for use in the United States. It's been used quite extensively in Canada, and the Americans have agreed that they will recognize that if people are fully dosed, and that's two doses, and in 14 days after the last dose, then that will be acceptable. We have engaged in them with another number of important discussions. We understand the concern about mixed dosage. You know, I think in Canada we've had a very positive outcome as a result of the decisions that were made in order to mix doses for Canadians. We are working with the Americans in a conversation last night. I know our ambassador spoke to their undersecretary at DHS, and we've offered to provide them with our data, our studies, all of the evidence and that supports the validity and the utility of the mixed dosage. It isn't a decision yet made by the Americans, but it's a very important discussion that's ongoing.
Okay, so we hope that's going to be critical, obviously, for millions of Canadians. And I can see the government's pushing on that. The WHO accepts it. The Americans are the largest supporters of the WHO financially. I can't imagine why they're not accepting the double dose. You talk about harmonization and symmetry. But the fact is, an American who wants to come to Canada can cross the border and show they're double vaxxed and then cross back. A Canadian is going to be able to cross, but to get back into Canada, we will require a negative PCR test, a COVID-19 test, for returning. That's expensive. It's time-consuming. Is Canada going to drop that requirement for fully vaccinated travels to harmonize with the U.S.?
Yeah, you left out the part that the American who came up to visit us would also have to have that same negative test. Now, one of the things we recognize that it can be onerous, and so one of the things that we have done is said that a test, if someone's going shopping in Canada and is going down to the United States just for an afternoon, and if they have a test that they've obtained in Canada, it'll apply as they enter into the United States and apply again coming back into Canada. So, you know, But the imposition of that requirement of having a negative test is something that was based on the advice that we received from the Public Health Agency of Canada. It has proven to be exceptionally effective in securing the safety and security and health of Canadians.
But why is it necessary if we got a double vax?
They're double vaxxed and they have to have that negative test. You know, we've put another layer of protection in, and our border officers and public health officials have managed that system very, very effectively. And so at the present time, the advice is that we intend to retain it. Oh. Now, I agree. The Americans have said that they are not going to do that. Quite frankly, I think it would be a huge challenge for them. They don't have the infrastructure in place that we've put in place in order to do that.
Right.
But we believe that it has proven to be a very effective measure. And, you know, we spoke to a number of premiers, for example, who were very concerned about international travels coming across the border, and we were able to provide them with additional assurance that the travelers would be double vaccinated and that they would have to produce a negative test in order to be eligible for entry into the country.
But Minister, it was manageable when we had basically non-essential travel wasn't allowed. And once that border opens, as you know, it's the busiest cross-border place in the world. That means that the volume is going to increase. There'll be fears of delays on that. So let's examine that. Just finally, when will the federal government announce a international travel passport? Forget the PCR test. We can, like the green pass in the EU. Here, I'm double vaxxed. Here it is for the US, for the UK, for Brazil, for anywhere you want to go.
Yeah, and Evan, we recognize the importance of an internationally accepted, essentially a vaccine passport that travelers can use that would be acceptable in other countries. And we are working very diligently in order to produce that. Now, in Canada, for all travelers coming into Canada, we have used an interim measure, the ArriveCan app, and it's proven to be very effective in ensuring that our border officers and our public health officials can obtain information to verify the validity of the double vaccination doses that a traveler is required to have. But we are working right now. We're working with the provinces and territories. It's an ongoing consultation because they're the holders of the data in order to develop an internationally accepted vaccine passport. And I know the officials working on that have advised that will be ready in the coming months. But we recognize the importance of it.
Right.
And so it's a priority for us. We'll get it done.
That is your Minister of Public Safety, Bill Blair. Couple things there. I do believe, and I've heard from some sources, that the American government will, by the time this border is open sometime in November, they will accept the mixed vax. So if you've got the mixed dose, I'm hearing, again, no guarantee, they'll accept that. And almost all the border state representatives, and I spoke to the New York Congressman Brian Higgins about that, they're urging Chuck Schumer, the senior senator from New York, Canadian ambassador to the U.S., they're all urging the U.S. to accept that, and the WHO does, and it should be safe. So we'll watch that. But I do think the Canadian position here, that you're going to have to get another PCR test 72 hours before you cross back into Canada, is both unnecessary and overly onerous. And the reason I say that is, if you are double vaxxed, that should be enough. You should not have to spend, and get this, $200. So you have to add $200 to your travel to the United States, especially if you're in a border town, to make sure you've got that PCR test. Seems unfair, unwieldy, unslow, and unnecessary. All right, got to take a break. Great story coming up next.
As the story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Yesterday on the program, we welcomed and were delighted to have Romeo Dallaire, retired Lieutenant General, who, of course, in 1994 was at the very heart of the Rwandan genocide, and he spoke so movingly about it again yesterday. And think about that word, the Rwandan genocide, because it was never supposed to happen again after the Holocaust, never again after the Second World War. But anti-Semitism is still on the rise, and we still see genocides taking place, as we saw in Rwanda, as we see now in the eyes of the United States and the UK and many others, in China with the Muslim Uyghur population. And the term genocide was coined by a guy named Raphael Lemkin after the Second World War to try to describe what this thing, this systemic effort to wipe out a people was. It was so beyond the scope of our vocabulary. And yet the scourge of anti-Semitism remains. And in fact, yesterday it became a political issue again as there was a global conference on Holocaust remembrance and anti-Semitism in Sweden that the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, attended virtually. And he decided to say, look, we have had this special envoy to preserve the memory of the Holocaust and fight anti-Semitism, but we're going to make it a permanent role now. Listen to this.
We're now making the special envoy role permanent and supported by increased resources. This is in line with Canada's commitment to promote and defend pluralism, inclusion, and human rights.
And who is the special envoy? Well, in November 2020, the government actually appointed someone named Erwin Kotler to that position, but he didn't have any money or support. He was just kind of, there he was. Now, you know Erwin Kotler. He's not only the former justice minister, he's been the champion of international human rights. He's been on this program many, many times, talking about the Uyghurs, talking about many situations, and he joins us once again. It's always a pleasure to have you, sir, on the program as the now Canada's permanent special envoy for preserving Holocaust remembrance and combating anti-Semitism.
Well, Evan, it's actually the office of the special envoy, and the special envoy position has been made permanent. I'm not going to be permanent.
You're not permanent, but the office is. But why is that significant?
I think it's significant because it institutionalizes the commitment to what was the theme of the Malmo conference that I just participated in and where the Prime Minister addressed it, both preserving Holocaust remembrance and combating anti-Semitism, but translating words into action. And this will provide us with a capacity now to implement, among other things, the country pledges that Canada made at the Malmo conference, which we are to implement during the Swedish presidency of IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, in 2022.
Tell me a bit about why this is so important now, because, look, there's a lot of hate in the world. Is anti-Semitism still a major factor? Maybe that's being overlooked in a world.
Well, anti-Semitism, we're seeing really an almost unprecedented scourge of global virulent, sometimes sophisticated and even lethal anti-Semitism. The empirical data supports it, but it's really, you know, the people themselves who are experiencing and suffering from it. I mean, what we are seeing, and we saw this in Canada as well, where Jews are threatened and targeted in their own neighborhoods and communities, on their streets and on the campuses, where synagogues were torched, Holocaust memorials defaced, cemeteries desecrated, institutions vandalized. I can just sum it up that we had the highest level of hate crimes against Jews in 2020 ever. And by May 2021, we had exceeded that level of all of 2020. Similarly, there's been incendiary hate speech on the social media, which is unprecedented. So when you combine this with the fact that studies show that a majority of millennials are not able to name even one concentration camps, do not know about Auschwitz as the most brutal extermination camp of the 20th century. And many of them get their understandings of what has happened from the social media. And this, too, is replete with too much Holocaust distortion and the like. You see that we have real responsibilities to act.
It's incredible how much education there's been, but one of the reasons is there's so many hateful situations. Look at the Uyghur situation you and I have talked about. The Yazidi situation that people feel like, the Yazidis, I don't remember that. In the Iraq situation, the Rohingya situation. There are stories of peoples who are almost unknown to most people, Erwin Kotler, whose plight deserves also, again, you can never compare agonies, and I never would, but it's an incredible array of agonies out there.
Well, that's it. The main thing in terms of the teaching about the Holocaust and the like, is to see the Holocaust as a paradigm for radical evil, and anti-Semitism is a paradigm for radical evil. But the lesson that emerges from all these horrific mass atrocities and genocides, whether we talk about the Holocaust you mentioned before, the genocide of the Tutsis in Rwanda, what is happening now, mass atrocities, the Uyghurs, is that what makes these mass atrocities, these genocides, so horrific are not only the horrors of the genocides themselves. What makes them so horrific is that they were all preventable. Nobody could say we did not know. We knew, but we did not act. Mm. And the whole purpose now at Malmo, et cetera, is to implement country pledges so that never again is not an idle slogan, but really means implementing a plan of action.
But now, you're now the special envoy for preserving that Holocaust remembrance. But at the same token, you've been openly critical of the Trudeau government for not acknowledging that China is committing a genocide against the Uyghurs. You've been on this program arguing that it hits the threshold levels according to the Geneva laws about what constitutes a genocide. So how, on one hand, do you accept a position like this? On the other hand, say to the Canadian government, by the way, this situation is happening and you won't even acknowledge it. Not acknowledge it, but you won't even call it what you believe it is, a genocide.
Well, number one, as you know, 266 parliamentarians from all parties, including Liberal MPs, unanimously voted to condemn it as a genocide. The government at the time abstained on the vote. I think it had something to do with the two Michaels. But then thereafter, Canada did lead a resolution at the UN Human Rights Council for the first time, which condemned atrocities, though did not call it yet a genocide, and in fact has participated in Magnitsky sanctions. We're not doing enough. We have to do more, and we have to call it out. But I'm hoping what happened at Malmo and the country pledges will result, as I said, of words becoming deeds.
Oh, is that right? So you think this could be a platform about, let's talk about this, but it's important to talk about it in context, that this may spur Canada to take tougher action on that as well?
I think that Canada has undertaken, through its country pledges, to learn the lessons of the Holocaust, to teach those lessons, to act on those lessons, and I would hope that this would find expression in the combating of mass atrocities and genocides wherever they take place and as horrific as they are.
Erwin Kotler, former MP, former Justice Minister, now Canada's Special Envoy for Preserving Holocaust Remembrance and Combating Anti-Semitism, an office which will be funded now and now is permanent, which is a big step forward on a very important issue. Always a pleasure, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Not at all. Good speaking with you. Evan,
yeah, you too. That's Erwin Kotler. Amazing guy. He's just been fighting for rights for people for so many years. We're going to take a break. Here's what we've got coming up on the show. The ambassador of Norway, after this bow and arrow attack that killed five people, and how they've gone totally electric, and a meteor that hit a woman's house and landed by her head. She's going to join us too.
Listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
It was horrible news out of Norway, where five people were killed in a bow and arrow attack, two others injured. Just a horrific news. And that news broke as we were trying to do a story about Norway that was remarkable, that the entire country is going to go to 100% electric vehicles early next year, a country with a similar climate to ours. So we called the ambassador to Norway Johan Fredriksson, the ambassador designate, and he joins us now. Hello, Ambassador.
Hello, and thank you for having me on the show.
I think my son and your son are friends. You know
that's
that.
True. They are.
Yes. This is what we realize, that when you moved here, my son and your son became good friends. I think your son's been at our place many times, so which is great. So, see, now I know you as a father, but I also know you as an ambassador. And I speak to you both as a father and an ambassador. A pleasure to be here. Before we get to the kind of positive story about Norway, and I just want to send our condolences out to the people of Norway. Can you give us any details about this bow and arrow attack, which seems so horrific and frightening?
Well, thank you. It's a really terrible thing that happened last night in Norway. It's I think already a big trauma for Norwegians in general, and not least for the people of the town of Kongsberg, who had lived through this nightmare last night. And I would just like to say thanks to all Canadians who have expressed their sympathies this morning for the victims and their families. So thank all for that, and including members of government and parliament. So thanks to everyone. I don't think I should go into details here in any way, because it seems there's an ongoing investigation. There are new details coming out in the Norwegian press all the time, and the police are giving press conferences nonstop. So I would just like to refer to what the Norwegian police are saying and what the Ministry of Justice is saying about this issue right now. So people should just follow the news.
Well, we are. Five people killed, two wounded in a bow and arrow attack. It, of course, brought back to mind the horrific attack in 2011 where the killer, I'm not even going to name him because I don't think he deserves the infamous name, killed 77 people, mostly young people at that camp. And that was one of the most horrific massacres we'd ever seen. And then you get this kind of horrific situation. Just last question on this, Ambassador, if I may. Is this considered yet, or is it being investigated yet, as a terrorist attack? I know the suspect's in custody.
The latest news from the police is that they are looking into that possibility. However, from what I can judge from the news so far, it may not necessarily look that way. At least it seems that the person that has been apprehended for this crime at this point is a disturbed person, as far as I can gather from what has been said. So it may not be the same kind of terror attack that we had in 2011, but we'll see what the investigation shows. The Norwegian security police are still looking into it.
All right. Well, listen, our thoughts are with the people of Norway, and this is a terrible, terrible tragedy, and obviously the world is looking at that. As you know, I invited you on to speak about what we thought was a good story when this attack happened. You know, Canadians are talking about phasing out fossil fuel cars and moving to electric vehicles. Norway is going to beat its projection and hit 100% electric vehicles by what, early next year? So, first of all, how is that happening, and is that ahead of schedule?
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking. And first of all, I would just like to say that what the latest development when it comes to sales of electrical vehicles shows is that in the incentives that has been in place now for the last few years really seems to work. Just to be precise, what seems to be happening is that the sales of electrical vehicles has picked up much more rapidly this year than was expected. So what the figure shows now is that in September, 9 out of 10 vehicles, that is non-utility, private-owned vehicles that are sold, are now electrical. So if that was to continue into 2022, in theory, there would be no more fossil-fueled cars sold as of April of 2022. Now, I think that is a mathematical projection. That's probably not what's going to be happening in practice, because, first of all, a lot of utility vehicles are still fossil fuel, of course, and What is more, Norway has a very big secondhand market for cars. We have extremely high taxes on cars. So cars are almost double as costly as they are in Canada.
But new cars, less than 5% of cars sold this year are gas powered, and 9 out of 10 new cars, basically by next year, are going to be electric or at least rechargeable. That's pretty remarkable.
It's very remarkable, and I think if you look at the year as a whole, 2021, there's been 62% fully electrical vehicles sold, or if you look at the total market, which was also remarkable. And new cars, privately owned, 9 out of 10 in September. So we'll see how it goes. The government has earlier said that it wanted to phase out the sale of new fossil cars by 2025. That's the political goal.
Yeah.
And that is also, we have a new government actually coming in today in Norway after our general elections early in September. And they say the same thing, that the ultimate goal is to phase out the fossil cars by 2025. If that happens earlier because of the market, I mean, that's great. I mean, that just means that the politics that has been in place for quite a long time is working.
And so Canadians are listening to this, and I just have a couple minutes. One of the things that first of all, does it for folks to say, hey, we've got a bigger country and longer distances, true, but Norway's got a very similar climate to us. So the winter hasn't been a problem. But the big thing to encourage is, like, how is this happening? Yes, I know Norway's is wealthy now, but after long years where it wasn't. But the big, I guess, incentive was if you buy an electric car, you're exempt from a 25% tax that others have. It's called the VAT tax or a value-added tax. So the incentives are huge. What incentives, what other big incentives are there to make the switch?
Well, I think the economic incentives have been essential. The exemption from the VAT, definitely. Also, there has been incentives on the mandatory insurance. The tariffs has been lower. Also, in the big cities, it has been allowed to drive your electrical vehicles in the bus lanes if you're commuting.
All right.
And also gradually the CO2 tax on fossil fuel has increased. So it's become increasingly more expensive to drive a diesel car or a petrol car.
Amazing.
And there have been other incentives as well. So this is, I think, the main explanation, because as you say, the climate is not necessarily ideal for electrical cars. But also, the infrastructure has followed suit, so there are more and more charging stations.
Right.
And I just looked at the program from our new incoming government that they will also increase the plans to build charging stations in all municipalities. So there is really sort of a broad effort.
And now you're getting an ambassador. Fredriksen, great to have you on the program, the ambassador of Norway, to Canada from Norway. And Norway, who's basically new cars are going electric. And do you think the Americans are paying attention? Well, during the Super Bowl, Cadillac hired the great comedian Will Ferrell, and Norway was the feature. This is what it sounds like to be the leader of a business where everyone's following you.
Here's Did you know Will that Ferrell. Norway sells way more electric cars per capita than the U.S.? Norway. Well, I won't stand for it.
Norway. Thank you, Norway, leading the pack. I really appreciate it, Ambassador. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, man.
My pleasure. Coming up, the father of a journalist who was murdered on TV. That's right, on TV. He joins us next.
Talking to the newsmakers every day. The conversation continues with Evan Solomon.
August 26, 2015. In Virginia, television journalist Allison Parker was doing her job. It was 6:46 in the morning. She was just interviewing someone working for a CBS affiliate. Job I've done 1,000 times. Job you've watched people do 1,000,000 times. But for Allison, something horrific happened. A gunman, mentally ill, former reporter actually, came in and shot her cameraman, Adam Ward, and then murdered Allison. She was trying to escape. The worst part is the gunman recorded the incident on a GoPro. That's right, a GoPro camera. And uploaded it, and it went viral. People wanted to watch the murders on TV, online. And then Facebook said, you know what, we'll remove it. Don't worry. All of our platforms, Instagram, Facebook, we own them all. We will do that so Allison Parker's parents and loved ones will not have to be viewed. But we've spoken about this on this program before. Here we are in 2021, and guess what? Facebook has not done it. Well, Allison's father, Andy Parker, who is a gun control activist and the author of the book For Allison, The Murder of a Young Journalist and Her Father's Fight for Gun Safety, is on here to ask Facebook again, do your job, do the right thing. Mr. Parker joins us now. Sir, it's a pleasure to welcome you back. Always an honor to have you on the program. Facebook is facing lots of hearings right now, but here's a broken promise. Why hasn't Facebook kept their promise?
Evan, thanks for having me on the program, and I appreciate your letting me share my experience and my voice here. But, you know, the answer to that question is it's unfortunately, it's, you know, cynically, they realize that murder videos, including Allison's, which is probably the most famous now, it's a moneymaker for them. And I have to give a shout out to Frances Haugen, who testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee last week.
Right.
You know, it's one thing for me to say, you know, these videos are still up. They're monetizing it. They know how to take this stuff down and they won't do it. She nailed it. I mean, she exposed Facebook. And the same can be said for, you know, YouTube and Google, because we filed an FTC complaint against them. It's almost 2 years ago, but they simply don't want to do it because they monetize it. And it's, you know, they want to keep people engaged on the platform. And that's what they do. And literally to the examples of the videos that, you know, that, a gentleman that works with me that's seen this thing way more times than he should, because I can't. You know, he flagged them to Facebook like you're quote unquote supposed to do, playing whack-a-mole. And you know, we included that in the FTC complaint, and guess, and when I was on CNN night before last, Facebook, they reached out, CNN reached out to Facebook, they said, oh no, they're all gone. Well, guess what? They're still up. They just lie. They're still up. They lie like you and I breathe.
Andy Parker, father of Allison Parker, who now says, and it's hard to argue, Mr. Parker, Facebook knows they're profiting from your daughter's murder and others, and you're saying they just lie about it. Have they had the humanity to even look at you in the eye and talk to you about this?
No. No, Facebook certainly hasn't. We've had, you know, my team at Georgetown University Civil Rights Law Clinic, we've had a video conference with some of the higher-ups with YouTube, and they just, you know, they just flat out, it was almost like they watched Mark Zuckerberg at some of these hearings, and he had this wide-eyed look of innocence of like, well, you know, there's nothing wrong. We're really trying. And that's, they looked at him and then said, thought, well, you know, we need to adopt that approach. And that's exactly what it was like. I mean, they just denied that, you know, that this stuff was still up, that, you know, we're working really hard. And, you know, every time they issue a statement, which we've all seen, it's like, you know, violence has no place on our platforms and yada, yada, yada. It's like they hit the play button on, you know, a pre-record And it's the same stuff I've been hearing for 5 years. And yet,
they do nothing.
Platform does anything.
They do nothing.
Nope.
And
because they know, that they don't have to. You know, that's the problem. They know they are, because there is no, they don't have exposure to any kind of liability because of Section 230.
Yeah, and here's the thing, Mr. Parker. I think the other thing is, and I will shout out to Vice magazine, who recently covered this, and we were reading the Vice story, mm-hmm. so we always shout out to Vice and other media outlets yep. who do good work here, and Vice did great work on yep. this program as well, on this issue. But Mr. Parker, what is doubly painful is if you are the family of a victim, like your daughter, Allison, it's like, it's your job to keep reporting it. It's like, let us re-victimize you again and again and again so you can, like, they have monitors. They know it. They've got algorithms. This is not hard for you. We get targeted ads on every damn thing that we do. They've got an algorithm. Anytime anything like that shows up about your daughter, it could be ripped down, and yet they put the responsibility on you and your families to do it. Like, it's crazy.
It is crazy. You know, we should not be self-policing. You know, that's what the crux of the FTC complaint is that they're violating their terms of service, which they state we don't allow this to happen. But yet when it's like, there's a video out there that's objectionable, the onus is on me or someone else that's in a similar position. And we shouldn't have to be doing that. And it's playing whack-a-mole, because as soon as you report that, if it comes down, which chances are it's not, another one will come, pop right back up.
So what do you need to do now? Like, like you're talking to Canadians here. I know you're talking to Americans. Canadians, by the way, have the same issue. What do you want done?
Well, Congress, the easy fix to this is that Congress must act. You know, the FTC is just sort of a first step, and it's more of a let's get Congress's attention and hope that the FTC actually rules on this, and then gets, so that Congress can then turn around and go, we need to do something. They've been talking about this. You know, there's one thing that I agree with Mark Zuckerberg on is, the time for hearings is over. We know that, we can trot him in there. They've heard from him. They've heard from me. They've heard from Francis Haugen. It's time to act. And the simple fix is, you do away with that liability, or the immunity from liability, because if Google and Facebook all of a sudden get hit with thousands of legitimate lawsuits, they'll stop that. I mean, it's death by a thousand cuts. And if they're forced to go to court, that's when they'll fix it. But Congress has to act.
Yeah, I mean, the question and the big thing that people say, I have very big empathy for the Parker family. The problem is, I don't want big government censoring the internet. That's what, you run into that. What's your response to that?
Sure. Well, there's a limit to free speech, right? You can't yell fire in a theater, and showing and making money from murder videos, that's not free speech. That's savagery. It's unconscionable.
I agree with you.
Society,
you don't have to draw a big line. It's a murder video. Pull it.
It's a murder video. It's not news. I mean,
to
a degree it's news, but you can say
it's exploitation. We know it when we see it. We don't need a lawyer to tell us. Mr. Parker,
that's right.
I love having you on the program, sir. We stand with you and your family and the fight that you've got to stop people profiting off this horrible tragedy, and your bravery and your willingness to talk is honorable and inspiring. Thank you, sir. We'll be right back.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
Hey, welcome back to the show, everybody. I want to ask a question of you, okay? What's the value of a university degree? Like, and an arts degree, not on science and engineering. Everyone talks about STEM, obviously very valuable. But a university is expensive. College is expensive. Post-secondary is expensive and it's getting more expensive. And there's this whole discussion that universities and societies are screwing up because people are spending money to get an arts degree. Or you studied history, or you studied geography, or you studied political science. Why? Useless. You're spending all that money, you won't get a job. And then universities are saying, why are we funding universities? Here are some articles. According to Harvey Weingarten, the former president of the University of Calgary and the author of a book called Nothing Less Than Great, Reforming Canada's Universities, 1 in 5 students in the Ontario College and University System are graduating with, get this, quote, literacy and numeracy values, levels that do not even meet the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Basic standards. In other words, what the hell's going on? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. My question to you is this. Should society be focusing on training people with education that is directly tied to jobs, or do you think there's a value to the, quote, humanities, the arts and sciences, the history degree, the poli-sci degree, the English degree, the philosophy degree? Useless or useful? Should we encourage or discourage? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Let me just give you some facts from different countries. Look, any post-secondary education, so if you go to school in any capacity, post-high school, so any post-secondary school, your wages go up considerably. Going to university and getting a bachelor's degree, your wages go up. Getting a master's, they go up further. So every degree you get, statistically, you will make more money. So education pays, and there's lots of data on that. In the U.S., for example, people say, well, I can't get a job if I've got an arts degree. Well, the truth is, according to the stats, the unemployment rate for people who graduate with a humanities degree is about 4%. And if you graduate with, you know, engineering or business, 3%, 1% difference. And salaries, though they start off higher for the STEM class, right? Like if you graduate, I don't know, with medicine or as a dentist or as an engineer, right? You probably are making more money, yes. But those disappear after a while. So, example, let's say you go into law. You're going to make, after a while, right, a fair bit of money, the same as an engineer. But get this, I'm going to read a quote from the BBC study. In the U.S., an undergraduate student who took seemingly most direct route to becoming a lawyer or a judge, majoring in pre-law or legal studies, can expect to earn $94,000 a year. But those who majored in philosophy or religious studies make an average of $110,000 a year. Graduates who studied ethnic civilizations earn $124,000. U.S. history majors, $143,000. Foreign languages, $148,000. $54,000 more than their pre-law. Like, it's weird because apparently most of those people go into management because managers make money. By the way, Harvey Weingarten will join the Rush today if you're listening on News Talk 1010 in Toronto at 2:50. Look at that. Look at the synergy we've got here. Some highly paid producer like Donnie probably making, I don't know, huge money for that kind of synergy right there. Thank you, Donnie. Very smart. That's why he's making the big bucks. What do you think? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Evan, we hire university students because our business is a university town. They have no common sense. They do not understand customer service, and they lack the basic skills of what's going on. I have a little answer to that. As someone who took 2 degrees at university, both in the arts and science faculties, where I think universities here fail is not that you should say, don't study poetry, don't study economics, don't study history. Those matter. And learning how to be a critical thinker and learning how to be a creative thinker and learning how people, those are all really important and a problem solver in the knowledge economy. But I do think universities have to have a baton passing. They have to have mentors with other with alumni who are who have made used their degree to go on in business, in law, or in anything in the entertainment world, to actually help people find that bridge. Universities graduate kids, and then they say, if you're successful, they come back and hit you up with money. They should have, you'll get a BA or a BA honors or a master's, and then it comes with a bridge. You could tap into a network to help you get a job. Universities fail students not before they graduate or during the process, but after. They should, for the money they pay, there should be a system and a network to help get a job or at least meet people. Evan, I'm an entrepreneur and I make $250,000 a year. Wow, well done. Most of my immediate friends also have their own companies and are making high six-figure salaries. None of us went to university. Success isn't determined by sitting in a class and learning math. Success is determined by dedication, perseverance, and experience. Hey, yeah, you're the exception and that's great. Remember, anecdotes aren't data. Like, you're 100% right. There's lots of people that didn't go to post-secondary that are millionaires. Bill Gates didn't finish university. Harry Rosen didn't. I understand that. But I'm just telling you the overwhelming data, the average salary of those who didn't go to post-secondary versus those who do is just, you know, statistically. So you're great, and I applaud your success. You just happen to be a statistical anomaly, just for the record. Which is great. That's probably why you're a good business person, because you're unique. Jocelyn, what's up?
When we look at manufacturing, we know how important manufacturing is in Canada, because we saw that we didn't have ventilators and masks and gloves during a pandemic. But what we haven't been doing in this country is training people to go into manufacturing. So we took all the skilled trades out of the high schools, told everyone that they had to go to university. And now we're in a skills trade shortage, and we have an aging workforce. So our manufacturing is going to be in trouble. And the other thing, you know, your point about, and I have a university degree. I understand critical thinking and how that's great. But increasingly, universities no longer teach critical thinking. They just teach, you know, how to be indoctrinated. So it's not helpful anymore. We need to really...
I think they should, and I appreciate the call. I hope they do. I got a kid in university right now. I hope they do teach, not in quote indoctrination, but it should be a free place to challenge. God, I have so many texts. We should have done this. Evan, my daughter's an undergrad, is in English. She's a corporate banking lawyer. Evan, your universities used to teach critical thinking no matter what the subject. Evan, I have a poli-sci degree. I'm working in a semi-related field where a degree wasn't even required. My degree did teach me to research and write. We need more numeracy proficiency. I get that. Evan, I have a bachelor's degree in outdoor recreation from Brock. Without it, I wouldn't be hired at a big bank's insurance company. Without that experience, I wouldn't have learned the ins and outs of business. I wouldn't have had the confidence to start and run my own company. There's a lot of problems with universities. Value, price, accessibility is all lacking, but I still wouldn't change it. Do I have time for one call? God, I have so many calls. Let me take one final call. I got to, Jocelyn, can you do something in like 30 seconds? Or sorry, Ryan, can you do something in 30 seconds?
Absolutely, I can. I don't have a degree, but I appreciate my colleagues who do have degrees, especially in the arts. They bring a depth to the conversation, be it philosophy, art history. One of my closest friends is an art history major. I tease him a lot about it, but definitely brings a depth and quality to the conversation. I'm a very technical person, and I need the arts to help me do my job.
Well, let me tell you something. You just brought depth to our conversation, and you did it in time.
You're standing on the shoulders of giants.
You are. I'll tell you why you couldn't run for politics, because you speak in short, smart sentences. Well done, sir. That's fantastic. No, welcome to the conversation, and I really appreciate it. Hey, we got to take a break. If you text me at 71010 if you want to come back to the value of education and what kind of education, that seems to have exploded. But a meteor just landed on a woman's house next to her head, and I want to meet that woman next. So let's continue that conversation and meet this woman next.
Helping you through these unique times, this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Okay, So we are just having this slapping conversation about education and my text board at 71010 is burning up and everything's great. And I want to continue going. But, you know, in the little journey that we take every day for 120 minutes together, when you get someone who is sleeping in her bed and she hears an absolute explosion and a meteorite punches through her roof and lands beside her head in Golden, British Columbia, you think, yeah, I think we better get her in the car. Ruth Hamilton is in Golden, BC, and she is now, I can't even believe I'm going to say this, a meteorite survivor. Ruth, man.
Hi.
What the heck happened, Ruth?
I don't know. I was sound asleep minding my own business. It was something up in the outer space that exploded and decided to join me in bed.
Okay, give... Well, something from outer space joins you in bed. I just want to be clear, folks. Yeah. It's a meteor, right? I think people might think this story is taking a turn here, Ruth. That was a movie. Something from outer space just joined Ruth in bed. No, folks, it was a rock. Okay, now what happened exactly?
I was sound asleep in bed. It all happened very quickly. The dog started barking. There was a huge explosion, is the only way that I can describe it. And then debris falling from the ceiling on my face.
And so you get up and you're like, obviously the dog's going crazy and there's a hole in your ceiling.
Yeah. I jumped up and went across the room to the bigger light, the overhead light. And turned it on, and there was a hole in my ceiling.
And holy mackinac. And then what? Like, what did you see on your bed?
Just the debris from the ceiling at first. I kind of looked out the window to see if a tree had fallen on my bed. That was the only thought that I could have at the time. And there was nothing there, so I grabbed my phone and called 911.
And what did you say to you? What did you say to 911? There's a call I'd like to get.
Yeah, I think it was something along the lines that I just heard an explosion and I have a hole in my ceiling of my house and I'm really scared.
Okay, so at this point, you didn't see the rock. You don't see the meteorite.
That's right. No, while talking to the operator, I was sleeping with two pillows. I flipped back the top pillow. And then I said, oh, my gosh, there's a rock in my bed.
There's a rock. So you saw the rock.
Mm-hmm.
How big is it?
Yeah. About the size of a man's fist, 1,270 grams, to be exact.
Holy mackerel. Now, did you touch it, or were you like, I don't know what to do with this thing?
I don't know if I touched it or not. I don't think that I did. The RCMP officer showed up right away and he came in and thought maybe it was from the blasting off of the Trans-Canada Highway where they're repairing the road. So he phoned them up and they said no, that they hadn't done any blasting that night and that they had seen a flash in the sky and heard two booms.
Oh my God. How close, Ruth, did this land to your head?
It was on the same pillow as my head, so.
Are you, so a meteor plummets from like the universe through the atmosphere and happens to hit the pillow, your pillow. And like, if this hits you, it's over, right, Ruth?
It'd been over or I had been so seriously damaged. I shuddered to think what could have been.
Oh, my God. Now, when did you realize this was a meteorite that has hit your pillow and wrecked your home?
When the police officer came back in, that was his first words. I think you've just been hit by a meteorite. And
and what was your reaction?
I can't remember. Yeah, it seemed like the only conclusion at that point.
Yeah, you're in Golden, BC. You're like, I get that. That's fine. Okay, this is weird. Have you had the rock evaluated?
No, not at all. I got in contact with Western University in London, Ontario, and they sent somebody else out on the weekend and picked it up and took it back to the university, and they're going to analyze it, research it,
right,
image it, and scan it, and they have it for a month. So.
But you're getting this back. You're not selling this rock.
I am getting it back. Yeah.
Has anyone offered to buy it from you already? Has anyone said, like, okay, Ruth, I want a meteor that hit the Earth. I'm prepared to give you X.
Not for what it's worth, no.
No price on this for you?
I don't have a price yet. The university said that they will help me with some people that can help me appraise it and stuff.
This is amazing. Now, what about the insurance company? Do they like, okay, is this an act of God? Like, I don't know how many calls they get when meteor destroyed my house call, but what did your insurance company say?
Well, they probably have had no calls like that. They've come out. They're asking for estimates for the roof replacement. They just had to do some asbestos testing on the ceiling material. And
right.
Once we have that back, then we can repair the ceiling.
Okay, this is like the coolest thing ever. Like, you're going to have this in your family. How do you feel? Like, do you feel lucky? Like, the universe has sent you some weird message. I don't know what it is, but it is amazing, Ruth.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel lucky that I came out of this unscathed. More than lucky, blessed, I guess. There must be a reason why I came through this unscathed. I'm not sure why, but my family's very thankful to have me around.
Oh, I bet. So you got this great chunk of. What do you think? You're going to mount it? What are you going to do with this thing?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It's gone away for a month, so I don't need to think of it right now. Get over the exposure it's caused in my life.
Yeah, you're famous now. Like, now, here's the other thing. Does anyone have a video of it plummeting to Earth? Because it must have been a fiery kind of plummet.
Yeah, there's actually a beautiful picture out there of over the Lake Louise. And it was a whole, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, Ho Quinn Photography. Yeah, maybe if you Google it or Facebook it, it's an absolutely beautiful picture.
Well, first of all, I hope you get the insurance to cover this. I hope you have an absolute, I don't want to say a blast, because you're so lucky. It's such a weird, then you're, you know, William Shatner's in space. Just get this. William Shatner had to go to space, Ruth. Space came to you. Look at that.
Yeah, that's just about it, right?
One of our texters said that Claire Palmister, the editor of the Golden Star, credits for writing the meteor story. Is that right? And if that's so, let's give the Golden Star Claire Palmister some credit. Or Palmster.
Oh, yes. Yeah. She's just so grateful for the story. It's such a big story for a little newspaper. And she did an excellent job of it.
Good. Claire Palmster, the Golden Star. Good job. Thank you, Claire. Check out the Golden Star. We love supporting local papers. Ruth, congratulations. Space came to you. You and William Shatner are two great space stories of the week. Thank you, Ruth. You brought a smile to our face, and thank God you're okay. See you tonight on Power Play.